So thanks for inviting me to talk. I thought today, well, yesterday I gave you sort of overview of this scenario and sketched some of the possible implications of being able to go through the initial singularity. Namely, that if you go through the singularity, you can connect the current state of the universe to the state of the universe in the next cycle. And so you can generate the density perturbations, for example, in the very late phase of the universe at low energy. So in fact one has inflation, which we're just entering, but it's low energy inflation, and the density perturbations are generated at the end of this low energy inflation through a mechanism that is completely different to the usual one. And so I hope I gave the impression that this is really a completely different way of looking at cosmology. And the door to this has been opened by the idea of being able to pass through a singularity. And it seems to me that this has been a sort of mental block, that people, since the singularity theorems, people have argued that because GR has to be singular at the beginning of the universe, or has to be singular as we trace it into the past, this sort of implies that time must have begun. But of course it doesn't follow at all, because we know from other arguments that GR is not the full story. And so our work is basically provides a what I would call an educated guess as to what happens at such singularities. So it's very exciting and very interesting, but obviously skepticism is called for as to whether or not you really can go through these singularities. And so I thought today I would just concentrate on that issue. I'm just going to concentrate on the singularity issue, and I'm not going to talk about all the other implications of cyclic models. Though I should say that really these models address all sorts of questions that inflation doesn't come near to addressing. Okay, so these models address the role of the cosmological constant in today's universe. They address the question of, was there a beginning of time? There wasn't one. And there's nothing like an alternative model to actually open your eyes to all the hidden assumptions in a standard model. And having worked on the no boundary proposal, for example, for the last few years, you know, the minute you say, no, we don't need to continue to Euclidean time, we can just let time run backwards, all sorts of things fall into place that didn't make any sense before. Anyway, I'm going to talk about singularity, but let me just begin by answering a couple of points that were raised in my talk yesterday. First of all, David asked the question, do I really need a positive lambda and to get cyclic behavior? So I was saying we zoom out here, get stuck on the hill, lambda then makes everything expand, wipes out the perturbations and black holes and entropy. And so you put into an attractor state so that you come back in more or less independent of how you came out, and that makes the system an attractor. Now, if you didn't have a lambda here, okay, what would happen is that the field would not run off to infinity because there is matter and radiation present. It turns out that if the equation of motion for the field, if you neglect the potential, is this, and if you're kinetic dominated, A goes like T to the 1/3, and phi grows logarithmically with time. Okay, so if you're purely kinetic energy dominated, the scalar field will run off to infinity. However, if there's any radiation, the radiation goes like 1 over a to the 4th, and that will come to dominate. And when it comes to dominate, as in this expanding universe, the scale factor goes over to t to the 1/2, and then you can see from this equation, phi dot is proportional to 1 over a cubed, which is 1 over t to the 3/2. So actually it converges. So if there were no lambda, what would happen is you would expand to this point, the scalar field will slow down and would stop, and then you would roll backwards, the universe would start contracting, and you would head for the next crunch. And so you would get into a state where perturbations grow unboundedly. And that would not be an attractor. That would be a rather crazy state, which would get wilder and wilder as time goes on. So,
what turns you around if you're, the principle if there's no matter, you just go with that potential forever?
It all depends on the sign of a potential.
Yeah, no, this is a potential for A, correct?
For?
For A.
Okay. No, it's a potential for phi. Potential for phi. So if the potential is not positive, then you will not get this attractor state. And so the idea is you will rattle around in there, not in an attractor, and explore other configurations, and perhaps there's some selection rule which at every bounce varies the value of the cosmological constant. For example, if it is determined by a form field, like a four-form field, then lambda will change from bounce to bounce, and once it's got into some value such that you have an attractor solution, then you'll remain in that state. Now, the other question that was raised was about density perturbations. So I hope this is an illustration of the fact that the presence of matter and radiation really strongly affects the motion of phi and this question of the existence of an attractor. And that's why I said that this argument of looking for an attractor cyclic solution actually is a new selection principle which gives us some hope of addressing the relative abundances of matter, radiation, lambda in the universe, which in sort of standard approaches to cosmology, there is no connection between the early universe and these numbers.
Before you go on to the speaker, can I just ask, is it crucial that the zero of energy is at the top of the plateau on the left?
Here? Yeah. No, doesn't matter at all.
At all? I mean, I could move it way, way down or way, way up?
No. If you make it diverge at minus infinity.
I want the same potential,
right.
I just want to vary to zero.
The reason we've set it zero is this argument that in the context of 11-dimensional M theory, the string, at small separations, small brain separations, you go over to weakly coupled string theory, and the string coupling constant is proportional to e to the phi, and that goes to zero as phi goes to minus infinity, so any non-perturbative effects should vanish faster than any power of this function, so they should actually vanish faster than exponential. And so we have just assumed this potential goes to zero very fast on this side. But it's not essential. It's not essential. Apart from this argument, there's no real reason for that to. The behavior of the potential over here does not have huge impact on anything, except if it diverges. Okay, then you get something much more singular, which in fact can't be resolved in this way. The Weyl transformation doesn't.
I don't know if I want to push this now.
Yeah.
I'm still confused. I mean, somehow on the right, I thought that you had a small positive vacuum energy.
Yeah.
Important.
That's right. That's right.
And now if I drop the whole thing by a large amount, it won't be small and positive. It'll be large and negative.
Absolutely. That'll change everything.
I thought I just asked.
No, I thought you were talking about this side.
No, but I want to move the whole thing.
Oh, fine. No, then it definitely won't work.
Okay.
Yeah. The other question was about density perturbations and whether or not this mechanism I told you about, which is falling off a hill in a static background, okay, whether that mechanism is generic. So what I showed you yesterday is it works for exponential potentials. And let me just mention the condition for it to work in general is that v comma phi phi over v comma phi squared has to be approximately 1. This is the...
Isn't that just the condition that it be an exponential?
No, not at all. If v goes like 1 over phi to the n, then this number here is 1 minus 1 over n. And if V goes like Gaussian, then that number is 1 minus 1 over 2 C phi squared. So Gaussian always works for any value of C, providing you do it at large enough phi. So it really is generic. And what it requires is the potential has strong negative curvature and is asymptotically constant. Now I should say one, if we take an exponential potential, so let me, the calculation I showed you yesterday does not include gravitational back reaction. Okay, I didn't include gravity, I just said the universe is static and the field rolls off the hill. When you include gravity, it gets modified, so you have to do linear perturbation theory with gravity present, and it turns out that if I take a potential like this, minus V naught times that, the spectral index of the fluctuations, which is 1 for scale invariant, this is just a sort of conventional terminology, 1 for scale invariant is actually 1 minus 4 over c squared. And the way to understand that is gravity amplifies long wavelength modes. After they've gone unstable, they self-gravitate. And the long wavelength modes go unstable first, so self-gravitate for longer. And so the spectrum is shifted to the red. And so if you want to make this realistic, you've got to have C bigger than 10. And the units I'm working in are 8 pi g equals 1, reduced Planck units. So you certainly need a large number in here to make it work. Okay, but that, and so there's a tuning, it's definitely a tuning of the model to make it work. So I don't want to give the impression this will work for any potential. And so far we've tried to get examples like this out of supergravity and M-theory, exchange of virtual brains. We've got models that are qualitatively like this, but getting this number to be 10 is difficult. So you can easily get 2, but 10 is difficult.
What about getting the amplitude of 10 minus 5?
That works out in a remarkable way, that the amplitude is naturally small. It's quite hard to explain the full details of that. We've got a long paper on the web called Density Perturbations in Apyretic Scenario. But basically, you can take, it all depends, when these brains collide, you produce radiation. And it turns out that in this model, if you assume that collision is adiabatic, so that there's no radiation, the brains just bounce, in that limit, then no density, the density perturbations do not survive the bounce. That actually you don't get density perturbations in the final universe. So there's a natural limit in which you get zero. If you look in that paper, you'll see that essentially if you pick this minimum of this, there's several parameters. There's the C, there's the minimum of the potential. And the crucial one is that as these brains come apart, they're going to settle at some distance, right? This plateau corresponds to some particular separation of the brains. And so the answer you get, if you interpret this in Hrabal-Witten theory, that separation is related to the ratio of the Planck scale to the gut scale. And the answer you get is suppressed by m gut over m Planck to some power. I think 4, I can't remember, it's in the paper. But if you put the numbers in, then basically the problem, the number you naturally get is 10 to the minus 7, okay, which is totally unlike inflation, where the number is actually 100. Delta over rho is 100, usually. And then it's multiplied by square root of lambda in inflation, and then you must pick the lambda to be 10 to the minus 14, so that this is 10 to the minus 5. So we're still debating this. It's not, Paul Steinhardt believes that if you think about this the right way, it's probably as tuned as that. Whereas I believe it isn't, and we're still debating it. But you know, there are many different ways of looking at the result. And but I should say the answer, if you take parameters from Harava-Witten is small. Okay, so now let me talk about the singularity. So let me just begin by discussing moduli space and the way we were led to begin to think about this crazy possibility of the two boundary brains colliding. And what I want to show you is that that moduli space is completely smooth at the point where the brains bounce. Nothing weird is happening there, and you can have a bounce happening at very small relative velocity between the brains. And at least from the background solution, nothing obviously goes wrong at that point. And then in the second part of the talk, I'll talk all about the perturbations, where things do go wrong if you take conventional GR. Okay, so let's take two brains, and we're going to have them sitting in a bulk parameterized by y, and give them a coordinate y plus and y minus, and then if the positive tension brain has to have for static solutions is associated with a kink in the warp factor of that form, and the negative tension brain has a kink of the opposite sign. So there is a set of configurations which are some particular function of the coordinates of the brains in the bulk, and there's a two-parameter family of static solutions. You can have these brains sitting anywhere in the bulk at any y, and that's a static solution. And this is, for example, in Randall-Sundrum, that's the simplest model where you just have gravity in the bulk. But this is also true for Harava-Witten, where you have another field, another scalar field, which is the size of the Calabi-Yau dimension, which is also a function of the of y.
Are you assuming a negative Kaczmarek constant or something?
Depends on the model. But in Randall-Sundrum, yeah, the assumption is that lambda is negative in the bulk. Yeah, there's some fixed lambda that's negative.
Is that that's the case you want to consider?
No, this statement is true for any theory that allows static brain solutions, such as Harava-Witten. Okay, but I'm going to show you what we've studied both in our papers. But the Harava-Witten is considerably more complicated, and as in my experience so far, the Randall-Sundrum actually gives a pretty good rough feeling of what's going on anyway.
Okay. To follow the moduli space, I want to take a look at the equation for it.
So fine. So I'm just going to write it down.
Oh, you're going to write it down.
Yeah. So let's. Exactly. In Harava-Witten, there is.
There's no what?
There's a scalar field. No, no. But that's why I said it's the volume of the Calabi-Yau. Yeah. Volume of the Calabi-Yau. So you construct a five-dimensional Lagrangian, and then you look for this type of solution, and there's a scalar field, which is the volume of the Calabi-Yau. Exactly.
Otherwise, it's known as a coupling.
It comes into the coupling, but it's not. The coupling depends on that, but it also depends on this distance. Let me think, which coupling? Do you mean like the gauge coupling?
Yeah, the string coupling is the size of the 11th direction.
Right.
But you want the scalar field which depends on that, which changes along that size. So that's not the usual string coupling.
It's a Calabi-Yau. Okay, so let me just give you a derivation for Randall-Sundrum, and then I'll tell you what the answer is for Calabi-Yau, for Harava-Witten, which we do not know the full answer for, in fact, because we don't know the full. We have not calculated this for the full moduli space of Calabi-Yau. It can be done, I think, but we don't know the answer. So I'm just going to tell you the answer for Randall-Sundrum. So let's start with Randall-Sundrum. And so we write down the action, which is gravity minus a cosmological constant. And so this is a five-dimensional integral. and then we will have a positive tension brain, which is a four-dimensional brain, and then we have a negative tension brain, okay, which is integrated, has its world volume. So that's the full action, and you have to be slightly careful because there's some surface terms as well. Now, to see that there are static solutions, you can understand the existence of the static solutions very simply. And in fact, you know, one question you might ask is, negative tension brains sound horribly unstable. If you increase their volume, they would go nuts, and does that make any sense? But in fact, it makes perfect sense. And the reason is they can be dynamical with this orbifold boundary condition. For example, let's just look at how the energy changes as I move this negative tension brain backwards and forwards. And you can see that as I move it this way, I get more, so the brain energy goes more negative because I've got more of it and it has negative tension. The volume is increasing, transverse volume is increasing in that direction. But the bulk, you get less negative. And if you just work out the balance between this term and that term, then the value of the tension at which allows static solution is precisely the value at which these two effects cancel. And so, in fact, if you want to, you can get more volume of the brain, but which makes more negative energy, but because you're losing bulk at the same time, that costs energy, and the net result is neutral. So it's completely neutral to, energetically neutral to the motion of the brain in the bulk, or equivalently to the change in volume of the negative tension brain. Now, so you do take this action, write down the metric which corresponds to it. So the metric is dy squared plus e to the 2y over l. This is for Randall syndrome. And now make these parameters. So the idea of a moduli space approach is to make the parameters in the static solution functions of time. Okay? And this gives you an ansatz for time evolution through on the space, along the space of moduli. So make these functions of time, substitute the static ansatz with this time dependence into the action, and do all these integrals. And when you do all the integrals, you get an amazingly simple answer, that the action is simply minus a naught prime squared plus a 1 prime squared, where a naught is equal to e to the, is the scale factor on the positive tension brain, y plus over l, and a 1 is equal to e to the y minus over l. Okay, so prime is this derivative with respect to, let me call it tau, this time. Yeah, tau is conformal time. Okay, so Randall syndrome brains in the slow velocity limit, this is only valid when they're moving slowly, are exactly the same as a free particle moving in Minkowski space.
Are you maintaining the issue of junction conditions for the moving brain?
Yes. So you solve the junction conditions for the static solutions, okay, and use those junction conditions in calculating the. So that's all built into the static ansatz, is that you've solved the static junction conditions.
For any separation.
That's right.
So you have
that's right. Solve. Now, you can say, do I believe this, okay? Because it's important to test this moduli space approximation. And luckily for Randall syndrome, you know the exact solutions, so you can test it very well. as I'll explain. But let me first sketch what the solutions look like.
That has, of course, negative kinetic energy for one of the sides.
Yes. Positive. No, the positive. No, no. The positive tension brain has a negative kinetic term. Somewhat surprising, but and in fact, if you consider a set of parallel brains, so imagine I've got a positive one here, and then positive, 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 negative, then I get plus, 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 plus all the way along. So the positive tension brain on the end is the only one with a negative kinetic term. No, that's just gravity. Gravity always has one negative. There are general arguments that any gravitating system ought to have one wrong sign in its moduli space action. And so, for example, so you see, if I just take a FRW universe with scale factor A of tau, then the action here is minus A prime squared in conformal time.
So that's just, well, that can be rewritten as the conformal part of the measure.
Absolutely. The conformal mode. That's right. Okay. Yeah. So let's just look at the trajectories here. And what I haven't put in is there's a lapse function. Of course, this whole thing is time reparameterization invariant. And so there is a lapse function there. And what that does is induce a constraint that a naught has to equal, a naught prime is equal to a one prime. And so if we draw the configuration space of these brains, then you'll notice that the static solutions only exist for the positive tension brain being at a larger value of the warp factor than the negative tension brain, and that means that A naught has to be bigger than A1. Okay, so the static solutions only exist for A naught bigger than A1. A naught equals A1 is the boundary of moduli space. And if we look at the equations following from this, they're trivial. You just have A naught double prime equals 0 equals A1 double prime. And the constraint that this quantity is 0, which tells you they must be null. And so the trajectories look like that. That's all you can have. And the one we're interested in is where the brains collide with each other, which is when A naught equals A1, and that is the boundary of moduli space. But they reach there in finite time, and they can be traveling along with an arbitrarily slow speed to get there. Now, so let me come back to whether this moduli space approximation is good. If you have a negative cosmological constant, planar symmetry alone is enough to tell you what the bulk is, in the sense that their planar symmetry in a negative lambda universe implies that there exist coordinates where the metric is static, and the most general possible metric with planar symmetry takes this form, where a squared of y is either e to the 2y over l, which is pure ADS, or it is cosh 2y over l, which is a black hole in ADS, or it is sinh 2y over l, which is in space-time with a naked singularity. And because of this, you can figure out exactly what the trajectories are. It turns out that the brains are, if they're moving slowly, I mean, exponential is very close to cosh. And so you've used, well, I'll just tell you what the result is. But basically, in this region of moduli space for these motions, the moduli space approximation agrees perfectly with the exact solutions. But when you come down to A1 being very small, it turns out the exact trajectories deviate like that. And the place they deviate is the place where the Hubble constant on the brain on either of the brains that you're following, if that Hubble constant times L is less than 1, which is saying that the time rate of change of the metric is small compared to this scale, L, if that's true, then the moduli space approach is accurate. And this regime is completely described within that limit, so there's no breakdown of the moduli space here. There is as you approach A1 equals 0. So then you have to decide what happens next. These two brains come along and collide with each other. And as I explained yesterday, the four-dimensional metric on the brain, the 4x4 submatrix of the 5D metric, which is in the slow velocity limit, is actually the induced metric on the brains. That induced metric is completely non-singular, and so you literally have these two brains moving together very slowly and touching. And then what happens next? Okay, so one alternative is that that's the end of time, and you go home, and that's finished. And the other alternative is the one that we're proposing. Okay, so we have these two brains moving towards each other, and at some point they meet, and what we're proposing is they simply go through. And so when they go through, the bulk has to reorient itself so that instead of increasing that way, it increases this way. So I'm going to give you some evidence that this is perfectly acceptable. I've not included Calabi-Yau in this at all. This is Randall syndrome. So effectively, I have frozen Haraba-Witten. Yes. Okay, so sorry, let me tell you what happens in... Let me finish this. Can I tell you now? Yeah, let me finish this and then I'll tell you what the M-theory result is, as far as we know. Okay? So when I look at that action, the free particle action, I can define these new variables. A naught is A cosh phi, and A1 is A sinh phi. And those variables on this space are simply the Milne slices on 2D Minkowski space. And what you see is that the action is equal to minus A prime squared plus A squared phi prime squared. And what that is just 4D gravity in a scalar field. Okay, so in fact, from this moduli space approximation, you can argue that because you know the answer has to be 4D covariant, okay, the motion of this the system here at long wavelengths should look like gravity and a scalar field, because the distance between the brains is a scalar field. You can argue that that must be the action. Okay, so 4D covariance is an extremely powerful argument in this context.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I'm a little confused because we come back to M theory again.
I'm just going to deal with the M theory. So that's yeah.
The distance between the brains is a coupling.
Yeah. The formula for the distance between, so if I make this change of variables, here's my minimally coupled scalar field. You can ask, what's the distance between the brains? And the distance is, L log cot phi with a minus sign.
L log cot.
Phi is this minimally coupled scalar field, which is defined this way. So tanh phi. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, that's A1 over A0. Exactly. And the point is that A1 and A0 are exponential, and that's why. Absolutely. That's all. But if you rewrite it in terms of the scalar field, you see, when we do cosmology, we always write the action this way in Einstein frame and scalar fields. And the point is here that D equals zero, right, is actually, so D goes from zero to infinity when phi goes from minus infinity. So phi is minus infinity when the distance is zero.
And phi in the free theory has a name. That theory you're actually interested in is called the dilaton.
That's right.
Why don't you call it the dilaton? Because it's not
scalar.
It is.
I don't mind. That's fine.
Not a scalar. We shouldn't interpret it with some other modulus of Columbia. It is the dilaton.
Right. It's a bit more complicated than that, because there's this volume of the Galabiel. And so basically this action has two scalar fields at least, and in fact more, because there's the shape of the Galabiel, there are various moduli associated with that, and they get tangled up with each other.
But the one that's flying up at the singularity
is together. Absolutely. Yeah. So the other scalar fields are not doing anything non-singular at this point. Anything singular at this point, I should say.
If I were doing this with an 11 dimensional application, from the point of view of the harmonic string, it's better and better as I work on speed coupling. All I'm doing is getting coupling to zero, nothing happens. So why doesn't, what is singular about the zero?
Well, normally that's infinite distance, but because of what the
field
is doing, it's finite.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, this is a point that's...
Probably you can represent the same conditions in modulus.
That's right.
But because... Mm-hmm.
So this is the metric on moduli space. It's minus dA squared plus A squared d phi squared. If you ignored gravity, this would be at infinite distance in moduli space, the collision of the brains. But because you include gravity, you actually get there in a finite time, because the trajectory you follow, the Friedman equation, looks like this, equals 1/6 phi prime squared. And what happens is that if you're contracting, okay, then phi will run off to minus infinity in a finite time. And so, as measured in this metric, it's perfectly finite distance to moduli to the boundary, which is just what this diagram is saying. Distance from here to there is finite.
This four-dimensional effect of Lagrangian you wrote down was derived in a very strange way, as far as I can tell. I mean, you had the moduli space approximation, you changed some variables, and then suddenly you introduced the four-dimensional metric.
That's
why don't you do it like just the usual Kluge-Klein reduction? Which
you can't, because the warp factor messes all that up. So as I said, this is a leap. Okay, from this equation, I did a essentially trivial calculation, and then we made this huge leap to say that the effective theory is this one.
Reinterpreting all of that in terms of some four-dimensional gravity theory.
That's right. But and I must say, I initially was very skeptical of this argument, because I thought 5D is not 4D. Right? How can 5D be 4D? But Seiberg really convinced us that, in fact, for long wavelengths, you should just forget about the 5D. It has to reduce to a 4D effective theory. And what else can it be but gravity plus scalar fields? And I think this argument is correct. I think you can do, you know, because there's no ambiguity about identifying these terms. A is a scale factor. It transforms in a certain way under rescaling space-time coordinates. This is a scalar field. And so there's no ambiguity about the identification of degrees of freedom. And then 4D covariance tells you this is all it can be.
So how do you know that there's no bind multiplying R
function? Because here it is, there's nothing multiplying it over there. That is R. Okay, this term is R. Yes, I mean, what you would like to make this argument more explicit would be to say that for every four-dimensional metric and four-dimensional configuration of a scalar field, there is a unique 5D geometry. Okay, which is in one-to-one correspondence and in some way represents the low energy geometry corresponding. And I think if one could make that, I probably one can make that argument explicit. in some sort of derivative expansion or something, okay, and then you would have a much more explicit derivation of this. But we don't have such a derivation, so
Let's start with the general flanking metric. I don't like math as part
of the. Absolutely, yeah, but that's probably very hard. Okay, so let me now mention the Harawa-Witten. What happens there? So as I mentioned before, there is the volume of the Calabi-Yau, which is another scalar field that comes into the static solutions, and you can think of the value of the volume, Calabi-Yau volume, on one of the brains, for example, as another scalar field. Okay, and when you work that through, you find that the action is not just this action, but there's another term, which you can rewrite in that way. So it is gravity again, but now with two scalar fields.
Many.
Or in fact, there has to be many, because there are many more moduli. I mean, there are all the shapes and the various complex phases and things, which are also moduli. And then there's a very interesting question, which I do not know the answer to, which is this metric with one scalar field is regular at A equals zero. Okay, that's just a coordinate singularity at A equals zero. If I have this metric, that's no longer true. Okay, because this really is singular at A equals zero. To make it regular, you have to imagine there's another field. Okay, so let's see. You basically, by adding another field, you can make it regular if you put in a factor here of let me write it this over F squared. Okay, because that's just an example, okay, that by adding another field, this is now regular because this is the metric on H3, 3D hyperboloid. That's perfectly regular, and that's another example of this Milne construction. You see, this Milne construction does generalize to higher dimensions, but only if the spatial slices have negative curvature. So then there's a conjecture, which is that if you did this properly for Calabi-Yau and put in all the moduli, the metric would be regular at A equals zero.
What conjecture is based on wishing?
Wishful thinking. Entirely wishful thinking. Okay.
Now, is a four-dimensional leap of faith, including this F field? So, I mean, I would assume that the way the A coupled to the phi sort of just reduces to the canonical coupling of the scalar field to gravity.
Absolutely.
But if you don't have that for the F, so F would have to couple very unusually.
No, this would just mean it's got a non-trivial Kähler potential.
Okay.
But those occur everywhere.
It's not inconsistent with coupling of gravity.
No, just has a non-trivial kinetic term. The general kinetic term for scalar fields when you have more than one is something like d mu phi a. D mu, in fact, I should put that down there. D mu phi b. And this is just saying you've got a non-trivial Kähler potential. So I think that would be a very interesting check. If it turned out this was singular at A equals zero, then that would be evidence against this approach. You know, it would be saying that somehow,
I'm sorry. I hope I'm not giving you a hard time.
Go ahead.
The magic here seems to be, at least what you presented so far, is you want to understand the collision of the brains. You're going to look at the moduli space approximation.
Right.
In the moduli space approximation, nothing is singular.
That's right.
You've got to go right through.
That's right.
But by the same logic, I could look at the Friedman equations for Robert and Walker universe, look at the ordinary differential equation I get for A, right? If we're a closed universe or something, it comes back down. The solution clearly continues with A being negative, and there's no problem.
No, curvatures are infinite, densities are infinite. I don't think there's no problem. differential equations are completely singular. If you have matter there. I think so.
I mean, A is zero. You don't
I don't think so. I don't think there's a... No, I think the differential equations are just too singular to allow you to get through the singularity. But let's get on to the perturbations, because this is more directly relevant. Because that's in a closed universe or in a contracting universe. Normally what happens is the perturbations will grow super exponentially as you approach a singularity, and they will, because they grow exponentially if the space is static. So if you're contracting, they go even faster. They grow like 1 over t to some power. And so they will just totally diverge. And so we have to study that next. This is just the background, and it's clear I can make sense of that by some matching rules, but it's not clear that the perturbations make any sense. So we have to look at that next. Yeah.
So let me understand the conjecture. This is supposed to be true for just a certain complexification, or for an arbitrary Clavijo, or what?
Don't know. All I'm telling you all I know.
Because you could probably check this for some simple.
That's right, and it'd be interesting to do it, and we haven't done it. So that's an interesting issue, just whether the A equals zero boundary is non-singular or singular. And I think this is not known. And it would be very nice to have some examples. And exactly, like an orbifold or whatever, might be enough to tell you what's going on. So there might be evidence one way or another as to whether this boundary is generically non-singular or generically singular or whatever. So I'm not going to talk about that. Remember, this whole subject's only 6 months old, so don't blame me.
This is a new anthropic principle. Only the Clavijo manifold that can get through the singularity.
That's right. That's right. That's right. Yeah, that's also possible. I should also mention there's an interesting paper by Larson and Wilczek, which is relevant to this, which is that if you have scalar fields with this type of funny kinetic terms, it turns out that some of them do not contribute to the energy. And they wrote this quite interesting paper speculating on what that meant. And so it's also possible that some of these moduli, in fact, do not. It's quite complicated, but... I don't remember, to be honest. You'd have to look at that paper. Basically, there's some constraints. I think that was the argument. Yeah. Contributed in some, yeah. But I don't remember the details. Okay, so now let's look at... So another point I want to emphasize is this is not very specific, this property of brains colliding. It's, in fact, it comes down to something that's universal in the sense that when one extra dimension shrinks to a point, you will always get this behavior. And you can see it in the following way. When an extra dimension shrinks to zero, then it becomes a good approximation to treat the warp factor as constant. And in that case, you can use the Kalitza-Klein reduction. Okay, so if d plus one dimensions go down to d, then let's just take pure gravity in d dimensions. In fact, I'm going to do it for 4 plus 1 going to 4. And so the five-dimensional gravity goes over to four-dimensional gravity plus a scalar field. And if we write down the five-dimensional line element, this is e to the minus, and again, I'm using 8 pi g equals 1. Five-dimensional line element is this. And so you've got 4D gravity in a scalar field. If you look at this theory as 4D gravity in a scalar field, the Friedman equation is this. And that implies that A is proportional to E to the phi over root 6 with the appropriate choice of sign. And from that, you see that if this 4D metric here is a squared times minus d tau squared plus dx squared, and you see that as A goes to 0, this term is precisely such as to cancel the vanishing of A. So in fact, this four-dimensional line element is not singular as the extra dimension shrinks to 0. And in fact, the exact solution of these equations is easy to get, and it's just minus d tau up to constants. It's just that. And that, as you know, is just a rewriting of flat space. So five-dimensional flat space is a solution of the five-dimensional Einstein equations, but from a four-dimensional point of view, it looks very singular. So let's just draw a picture of the space-time diagram in the five dimensions. And so y and t, when we draw Milne coordinates again, if I say, sorry, that's not y. There's some Minkowski space coordinates, t and y. And if I slice the space-time like this, so these are surfaces of constant y, and this is t, then you get this tau, I should say. That's the metric you get. And what you do when you do Kaluza-Klein compactification is you identify y equals 0, which is this line, okay, with y equals L, say, which is that line. And so, in fact, what you have is a double cone where the extra dimension shrinks to 0. And you might say that's just the end of time here, or you might want to follow it through. And if you follow it through, that's what we're advocating, is that you simply follow it through. So obviously the five-dimensional theory breaks down at this point. It's four-dimensional at that point in time. But the four dimensions, the extended, sorry, I should say the three spatially extended dimensions are completely non-singular at this point. So one way of describing this, I mean, certainly if the matter, couples to this this metric, four-dimensional matter couples to the four-dimensional induced metric, which is what would happen for matter on the brains, then its density will remain finite at tau equals 0. So I think what this map does is it, I would say it solves 99% of the cosmic singularity problem, but not all of it. It removes infinite curvatures, it removes infinite densities, but the one dimension has to shrink to a point for one instant, and therefore you violate principles of general relativity, but in the mildest possible manner. You have to study it, but it's not singular. You can look at field excitations that depend on this direction, but it turns out that as you approach the singularity, basically everything ends up looking like a massless field, and you don't get singularities in the mode functions of the 5D matter. I can try and construct it after the talk, but it'll take me a bit of algebra. Okay, so what I'm going to...
This length is going to 0.
Right.
If I have a mode that depends on this length,
right. Massive. Right, right.
So is that what happens? These things just all go up to infinite matter?
Okay, let me think about this.
That's the usual problem. Any energy at all in a universe which has a volume going to 0 gives you infinite energy density.
Yeah. Okay, let me show you that calculation. So I think that's the wrong way of looking at the problem. In the sense that if you're going to, you know, so you're more or less advocating calculating this. Yeah. That's the wrong thing to do. What you should do if you want to study gravity coupled to matter is consistently do linear perturbation theory with gravity and matter and calculate correlators and see what they do. This doesn't really, you're not going to couple this to the matter. Matter, you know, the metric is a quantum operator. You need to solve its equations of motion. So let me tell you what happens when you do that. Calculation of gravity coupled to scalar field matter.
Same thing, could that at least stuff out too? I mean, this is talking about virtual fluctuations, and you're not going to see it, are you? There is a divergence in that thing.
Right.
You're not going to see in your calculation. Not because it's not there, but because you're doing a different calculation.
But because I did what?
Because you're doing a different calculation.
That's right. Yeah.
So you're going to explain where the left side goes, you're sort of north.
I'm just saying, who cares what that does? I want to solve the modes of the theory. I want to solve what the metric does.
But you're doing class response theory.
No, I'm going to do perturbation, quantum mechanical perturbation theory.
You're going to calculate correlation functions.
Absolutely.
Okay, but there is this thing as well.
Yeah, no, it's there somewhere, but let's just calculate it. That's all I'm saying. Let's calculate it including gravity. It's not hard to do. Yeah, that's what we always do. Cosmological perturbation theory includes gravity. That's what we should do. So let me show you the.
Your starting point isn't valid. You can't do linearized perturbation.
The only way, as far as I know, of checking whether linear perturbation theory is valid is to compute and see what you get, and to see if the second order terms are bigger than the.
Of the metric is this divergent term.
You have to be very careful to pick gauges to do it properly. And so I'm just saying, let me show you what happens when you do it properly. This is not, you know, you might just compute this, but in a fixed background. Let me show you what happens in the calculation.
Is this stable to correction? Say if you have an R squared term or higher powers of the curvature, is what happens at this point sensitive to the coefficient of those terms?
Absolutely.
And you're going to say it is not?
No, I'm not. Okay. In fact, those terms are probably the
so
hope.
Is there, in some sense, a way of parameterizing some of the quantum correction?
Right.
Gravity.
Right.
And if the answer depends sensitively on what happens there, then
absolutely.
Fly here
absolutely. So I think Joe and Natty, you've been doing calculations of this, and as far as I understand it, they're
result.
What?
We have no result. There's nothing you can cite. You can't cite.
All right. Well, I've talked to Natty, so I can cite what he told me.
Have you talked to him since the weekend?
No, okay, so before the weekend, they had the following result. Can I say what your result was before the weekend? And you can tell me if it's gone away.
Yeah.
As far as I understand it, the result before the weekend was that when you considered massive particles sitting on the space-time, and you considered the density, the final density of particles generated with an incoming vacuum state, that final density was a number which was independent of the regularization.
Okay, that result is still true. That's okay.
So that result says that, you know, some quantities are finite and independent of the cutoff.
I don't know what you have to explain what that means to cut it off and how you cut it off.
Sure. Okay. Sure. So let me get on to that. Okay, so I'm going to give four bits of evidence that you can go through. None of them is compelling or settles the issue at all. But what I would say is that I have not seen a you know, no-go theorem that this cannot happen. And I'd also say that for anyone who says this cannot happen, they have to explain what does happen. And nobody has any statement about what happens, apart from, as far as I know, apart from ours, which is simply that the brains pass through. So I think what we're doing is the most conservative thing you can do. If it doesn't work, then it's a real challenge.
Actually, let me just give you another. Brains, when you switch over to each other, often stick. I mean, not time has to end. If you just stick, is another possibility.
If the positive and negative tension brains stick, right, then it's even more dramatic than what I'm saying. Because then you've gone from the dimensionality of space-time has changed.
That's okay.
Permanently. No, okay, that's fine. But it's permanent. I'm saying it changes for one instant. You're saying it changes forever.
Right, the things when thrown at each other usually stick. They usually
Are you playing squash? you're ruling out most sports.
It might be weak coupling.
Zero. Okay.
No, weak. I mean, stick with it.
And weak coupling, that's possible. Yeah. That's possible. So I'm going to show you a calculation which allows for that possibility as well. Basically, energy and momentum conservation certainly allows for that possibility. And we can't. But what I would say is momentum conservation. If you only generate it's all to do with how much radiation you generate. If you generate lots of radiation on the brains, then they'll stick. If you don't, they won't stick. Yeah.
Is there any reason they can't come out faster than they went in? Because there's no conserved energy in the problem.
There is.
What is conserved energy?
Okay, that's what I'm going to show. They actually can come out faster than they went in, but only by square root of 4/3, some weird reason. And only if you make more matter, this is only for brains, and if you make more matter on the negative tension brain, then there's a funny loophole, which means they can come out faster than they went in. But I'll show you the calculation. All right, so let me now deal with this problem by including gravity. So what we want to do is to say the stress energy, I'm just going to do linear perturbation theory, that's all, okay? And certainly this argument, if it was valid, would say, you know, the stress energy is diverging, the metric, if box H couples to this and that diverges, H will diverge and you'll get nonsense. So I should see it if I do a full calculation in linearized gravity. If there's a problem, I should see it. Okay, there may also be problems at nonlinear level, but let's just do the linear one. So what I do is I say the stress energy tensor is a stress energy tensor of the background times 1 plus delta. And now you have to be rather careful and define what time slices this equation is supposed to hold on. And there's a treatment using gauge invariant variables, gauge invariant cosmological perturbation theory.
This is stress energy tensor of what? Of matter in this background?
Yeah, just the scalar field. Just the scalar field. Okay, so we have a scalar field coupled to Einstein gravity. And you can study it's complicated because the fluctuations in the scalar field get related to fluctuations in the metric. There are constraints and there are all sorts of technical complications. But these were all sorted out by Bardeen, okay, in his famous paper. And what Bardeen said is that there is a particularly nice variable to look at, which is the energy density perturbation, delta, on co-moving slices. And what that means is it slices on which the momentum is zero. So you've got the scalar field, and it moves. These slices are actually the same as the constant scalar field slices. So you can always slice your space-time on surfaces of constant scalar field, and then you can measure the density perturbation on those slices, and that is a gauge invariant physical quantity. Okay, so Bardeen wrote down T00's background is blowing up, but that is frame dependent, okay, in the sense that the density here, if you measure it in Einstein frame, it would be 1/2 phi prime squared over a squared. This blows up like 1 over a to the sixth. However, when you change frame to when you vial transform to basically this this frame, in which to the brain metrics, if you ask what's the density on the brains, the density on the brains is totally finite at collision. There's no infinity there. And so that's the whole argument, is that this infinite density is in fact just an artifact of using the wrong metric. If you'd stuck to the 5D metric and follow the density of matter in the 5D metric, it would be finite. Okay, so the upshot of that is that you can always change your definition of density by a vial factor which such that this is finite. That's how we resolve the background solutions. We've changed to completely finite variables, and we thought we knew what we were doing there. Okay, everything was finite in treating the background.
Yeah.
You want to insist on Einstein frame, and Einstein frame is singular, as I've explained.
Well, this is not just like the difference between Einstein and string frame in string theory. You're actually doing the dimensional reduction. So in the picture where space-time looks like that Lorentzian cone, you have only gravity. You don't have a scalar field in five dimensions.
That's true. This calculation, I agree with you. This calculation I'm going to tell you, I'm phrasing in 4D terms. But I agree it can be completely rephrased in 5D terms, in which case this delta here has to do with perturbations to the radius of the fifth dimension. You can rephrase it. It's equivalent language. Okay. So if I had written this in five-dimensional perturbation theory, okay, then I wouldn't have this infinity there at all. Okay.
But still, you have all the metric perturbations.
Yeah, exactly. So let me talk specifically about this one, which is perturbations to the radius of the fifth dimension. And what I'm going to show you is something quite remarkable that's in Bardeen's paper. It wasn't noticed by him. But there are very special properties of massless scalar fields, which is that the density perturbations do not diverge at singularities of this type. Okay? So if you look in Bardeen's paper, with a little bit of work, you can find a...
Are you thinking four-dimensionally now or five?
Let's think four-dimensionally, but in terms of the fractional density perturbation.
Why do I focus on a massless scalar field in four dimensions?
Because that's what you get out of the 5D.
And we also get massive modes.
Let's do
the modes that go bad at the singularity. The massless mode, I agree, will just go through.
Well, no, Gary was saying that's infinity. Let's deal with that first. First things first.
But the ones that are, these ones that are getting high energy right now are, from the 4D point of view, very massive.
That's right. If a particle gets very massive, you just don't excite it.
Not if it's sitting there with its mass, which is getting bigger and bigger.
Fine. Let me deal with massless first, okay? We can discuss massive later. But
massless
personally, I don't... What?
4D.
Massless and 4D. Let's deal with the phi field, okay? Well, this is dramatic enough, right? To say if I can get through a singularity with massless scalar field. That's a very dramatic statement. So let me just show you that. We can discuss the massive later. I don't believe it's any different.
The mass is going to be different.
No, you can still go through. It's certainly different, but I don't think it's any worse. Okay, so you work out the equation of motion for this delta, and what you get is the following differential equation. And if you, initially, let's just, let me just write down the solution of that equation. General solution of that equation is delta 0 times 1 minus, I'm going to do an expansion in small times, so that's to be near the singularity, so this is the general solution. Okay, it's a sum of two power series, but what you notice is that they're perfectly finite at tau equals 0. There's no divergence in delta. And this is a special property of matter where the pressure equals the density, which is what this matter is. Massless scalar field has pressure equal to density in the background. And if that's true, then when you follow a density perturbation in a contracting phase, it grows, but it just hits a finite limit at t equals 0. So you still have a problem because there's this log, okay? And what that's telling you is you really have to regularize this in some way to get through that logarithm. But it's completely subdominant, okay? And so the leading behavior of the solution is going to be insensitive to that regularization. So you can actually evolve these perturbations right to the singularity, and they're finite, and therefore correlators of them will be finite too. Okay, I can quantize. This can all be phrased in terms of quantum mechanical operators, and if the mode functions are finite, then the correlators are finite. So gravity actually helps, makes it less singular. It's completely finite. So now let me talk a little bit about regularization. And this is actually, before I mention regularization, let me mention what happens with the tensor perturbations. Because as I mentioned, the scalar perturbations are always, if you have a metric and you do a Weyl transform of it, you can make what looked singular, non-singular, for scalar perturbations. But for tensors, they don't change, okay? If I've got some metric and I go to e to the phi times that metric, this does not alter the tensor perturbations at all, because the tensor perturbations are unaffected by fluctuations in that scalar quantity. So let's look at tensor perturbations. These obey a differential equation like this. And you can do this either in the 5D language or in 4D language. It's exactly the same. What in the 5D language, if I represent the 5D space-time as y here, t here, then the extended dimensions are over there. Okay, so I have these two brains coming in and colliding, and I can ask what happens to tensor modes when these brains collide, modes depending on this three-dimensional spatial coordinate, and they look like the following. And what you notice is that there's the opposite sign here. And what that means is that the solution to this goes like log tau. So the tensor perturbations do diverge at tau equals zero. And what that's telling you, it's interesting to think what that means. This divergence is only going to be cured by regularization. Okay, and I'll tell you how it can be cured by regularization. But it's interesting to think what this means physically. So if you go to the 5D metric, it looks like this. And then dxi dxj delta ij plus hij. Sorry? Absolutely, yeah. Synchronous gauge. So the synchronous gauge metric perturbation will look something like that, and it diverges as you approach t equals zero. What does it mean? It's quite easy to see what that means for the nonlinear theory, because this has to be traceless. Okay, so let's take an example. Take H11 to be log tau, epsilon log tau, some small parameter. Actually, the small parameter is really h bar, because these are vacuum fluctuations. 2 to be minus epsilon log tau. So that's traceless. And now if we try and write down a metric with such a perturbation, you can see where it's going, that it goes straight to the Kasner solutions. Dx2 squared t to the 2r. Okay, Kasner solutions are like this. They're anisotropic. And they obey a constraint. These are solutions of the 5D Einstein equation if these exponents add up to 1 and if their squares add up to 1. Okay, so if I, there's the way to solve this is if I say P is 1 plus a small perturbation, then I see there is a solution where Q is epsilon and R is minus epsilon, because that solves this equation to order epsilon, if that is order epsilon squared, and then all of this is 1 to order epsilon squared. So what goes on here is that this is to leading order the same. This is 1 minus epsilon. That is epsilon. That is minus epsilon. And so in the Kasner solutions, one dimension of the brain shrinks to zero, and the other one blows up to infinity as they approach. Okay? And that is where these tensor perturbations are heading. Okay? Which is bad. It sounds, it just shows you that 4D gravity can't get through singularities like this. So what's happening? But let me just point out that the behavior of this logs are very slow, as you know, right? So this log divergence, if I plot log of tau, at large tau, I actually should have included the k squared term, which makes it oscillate. So these modes are really oscillating, and then they come in, and if this were the full Lagrangian, the modes would blow up in that direction. That all happens in one Planck time. Okay, so according to this theory, 5D gravity, pure 5D gravity, the brains approach, and then one Planck time before collision, one extended dimension shrinks to zero, and the other blows up to infinity. If you regularize this problem, okay, which is to say, and basically there are a number of regularizations people have played with. So let's say that we don't believe GR, which we don't. And so it's another epsilon. Let me call that T string squared. Let's imagine the true theory of gravity actually has a cutoff, T string. And so really this double cone should be replaced, okay, in some way we don't quite understand, with something whose neck is TS. And then the question is, if I do calculations in this background, do the answers depend strongly on TS? And this quantity I mentioned before, the density of created particles, seems to be independent of TS under certain conditions. It actually requires that the mass of the created particle be much smaller than that cutoff. So the created density of particles whose mass is much less than the string scale does not depend strongly on that. Okay, so now let's look at what happens here. If I do, this is a total cheat. I'm not trying to pretend anything else, okay? This is trying to anticipate what stringy corrections might do to the metric, okay, in some very rough fashion. Another way to regulate this, and you want to see that the answers are independent of regulator, obviously, is to simply chop that cone on a circle and join it on a cylinder. And you'd like to see that that gave the same answer as that for low energy excitations. Now, what does this regularization do? Turns out that either of these regularizations, if you work it through, say that the tensor perturbations, in fact, go to zero at t equals zero, and they come out the other side on the log. Okay, so they come out with a minus sign. So just this small change completely removes the divergence. Nothing is infinite, and the tensor mode will oscillate. So in that picture, the two brains meet.
I thought it was log T always.
Well, he's modifying the solution because he's modifying the geometry.
I modified the background geometry, and then I solved the tensor equation.
Switching the minus log down.
I'm saying that is the solution of the equation. So if I write down the equation, the equation is now H double prime. It was this equation. And what's happened now is that this has turned into T over T squared plus TS squared. And the effect of that change, so where you had a singularity in the equation at T equals zero, you've removed it. And this is now the solution with the regularized equation. Another way to view this regularization is that you're evolving in the complex T-plane, okay, and there's the singularity at T equals zero. And so what should you do when you hit that singularity? One thought is that, you know, since you've got a, you might go round. But the problem with that is that log T will then get an imaginary piece if you go round. So you can't do that. And what this regularization here does is it splits the pole. Turns out, is that right? Right, so the poles now are at plus or minus ITS, and that guarantees the solution's real as you go through, and that's what this regularization gives. Okay, so likewise, if you follow that quantity delta, which is the density perturbation, then it turns out that this logarithmic term gets altered. But essentially, it's quite easy to understand what happens, that the delta as a function of t also does something like that.
Sorry, I guess I'm a little confused.
Okay.
Turning on epsilon, why does the solution go to zero and not to something?
Because this really becomes t to the t squared plus ts squared, the epsilon.
That shouldn't. You're saying it's not, if I take that solution, that epsilon goes to zero, it has a finite range. The solution.
Think about that. Yeah.
You have to go to log epsilon or something. We're going to have to see an epsilon someplace there, otherwise. If that's a solution.
That's at large. No. There's certainly an epsilon here. The epsilon is important in this region. What?
But it's finite.
The region over which it's important is.
You said you wrote the solution as if it's going to zero at tau equals zero.
Yeah, it is.
Any epsilon.
Yes.
Including the limit as epsilon goes to zero.
Yes.
So why isn't there a solution then for epsilon equals zero, which is
Because it's the order of the limits.
That's a
it's the order of the
for
limits.
Any epsilon going to zero.
You mean TS goes to zero?
When you say epsilon, you see this epsilon. Yeah. Do you mean TS going to zero?
I mean TS.
Okay, fine. Yeah. Right.
Singularity,
right?
Show up usually
in the
solution.
So,
right?
Say it another way.
As the regulator goes towards.
Suppose your logarithm.
No, they don't. Okay. No. Wait. That's not true.
Show me.
Okay. So let me give you a simple example. Here's a differential.
Anyway, Neil, give us an example of solution.
I've got it in my notes in my office if you want to see it.
Log
of T over T S.
Absolutely. But you see, what you would do is you normalize this to the vacuum fluctuations out here.
Besides, the problem is that T equals zero. So how does that doesn't really work with divergence. That doesn't vanish.
No, it's not. Well, it's not exactly this. It is, I'm trying to remember. I can try and derive what it is for you, but I can assure you that it does go to zero there.
But then you subtract it from infinite. And you subtract the opposite infinite on the other side.
Yeah.
It doesn't make any sense. Where does that subtraction come from?
It comes from the fact that the metric wasn't given by pure gravity. And this is a guess as to what the correct metric is.
You started with a small fluctuation, and then it's blowing up.
Blows up.
And now you regularize it.
Absolutely.
And you subtract an infinite amount, and it doesn't blow up anymore. That's not fair.
It's not fair.
It's called renormalization.
I thought you should.
That's what you're doing in normalization.
Right.
Infinite amount. You put in a regulator.
Right.
You say, okay, I'm going to subtract.
That's right. That is what we're talking about.
But that's not fair.
Well, maybe it's not fair.
You're not taking TS to zero, right? No. So I assume you're using the fact that log TS is not a really big number. I mean, is that somehow implicit in what you're saying?
That's what I would say. No. I'm not taking TS to zero. I'm not taking TS to zero. Why am I? What I'm asking is that if I ask, so what I would ask is that if you keep TS fixed and finite, the properties of long wavelength modes much longer than TS will be independent of TS. That's all I'm asking.
If I look at this solution way out there, for mm-hmm. Large Tau, mm-hmm. right, the regulator plays no role.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You see, that's obvious in this picture.
Except when you make the subtraction. Are you making a subtraction or not?
I'm not making a subtraction out here. In this picture, I'm solving the modes, right, on this cone. It doesn't know anything about the singularity.
Right.
It's going to behave exactly as it was. Then I put in a little cylinder here, and out it goes again, and what you find is the solution does this. Okay? So the size of this region depends on TS. But that's all. So the solution is doing, I shouldn't have written this, the solution is doing whatever it was doing before. Which is heading towards blowing up, and then I cut it off with this construction. Okay, so...
I guess what bothers me is that before it gets to that, so you're really using, as Joe said, the fact that, because as TS gets smaller and smaller, the place you're cutting off it becomes more and more negative, kind of closer to negative infinity. So why do you cut it off before, for example?
Because, okay, let's think. So then we have to get quantitative and see how big the amplitude of these modes are, okay? So we've got some h-bar, okay, which is measuring the amplitude. In fact, it is square root of h-bar of those modes. And we want to ask, now let's see, there's a dimension, it's dimension...
If I take your picture and
yeah, it's dimension
much smaller TS, wouldn't you in the sense be saying this? You're cutting it off here.
Yeah.
And switching from here. From here to here. Because eventually this is going to minus infinity.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I cut off and attach it to here.
No, I don't, so because I take this cone
you do it
and
earlier,
I cut it here.
If I continue to make TS smaller and smaller, closer and closer to something like this. Where I'm taking this solution.
No. Oh, I see what you're saying.
Right? So as TS gets small enough,
yep.
It's supposed to go to zero in some streaming, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then I'm really making a transition from this to this.
Mm-hmm.
That's what happened before and after,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Which looks a lot different than what you drew.
Mm-hmm.
This looks awfully singular. Jump for me.
But you're insisting on taking T0. You see, I think the amplitude...
I'm going to take TS as small as I can to get to this picture.
And the problem is, if you think of way out here where it's oscillating, it's got some amplitude that has nothing to do with TS.
Yeah,
I agree.
So it's
exactly.
Oscillating around, and then it starts all...
Right, and basically that is...
Yeah. It's trying to go down.
Right.
And now, how does it know not to get really big before it hits TS?
And basically, there's a time scale that comes in, which is the Planck mass, Planck time. So it gets really big.
You can adjust it anywhere you want. It's up to you.
Yeah, right?
But if you think about it as a regulator,
right,
then eventually we get into the position where you're saying it's...
No, that's why I think you can't take it to be too small. It shouldn't be smaller than the Planck mass. And I think if you take it to be the Planck mass, then the amplitude of these fluctuations does not go to zero. I mean, they do not run off to minus infinity, and you're in this situation rather than that.
But that's got to be a one or number, like one or two.
Yeah. No, I agree. I mean, these are good points.
It just doesn't look to me as smooth as you've drawn it. You've drawn it as if it's a nice, smooth thing. You can just easily do that. This picture.
What I'm plotting is that... No, this isn't right, David, because this is not right. I have not cheated in any way. This is the solution. If I solve the differential equation, okay, I'll tell you exactly the differential equation I'm solving. The differential equation is this one, h prime equals equals minus k squared h. That's the differential equation, okay? In the background solution, the double cone, you have a going like tau to the 1/2. And this produces the 1 over tau. Okay, so what I am doing is I'm solving the equation where a comes down, goes across, and goes back out. Okay, and this is what the solution looks like. There's no jump. The differential equation is perfectly perfectly regular.
It corresponds to putting in a subtraction of the log cutoff, which on those amplitudes for large tau, which doesn't make any sense.
No, I evolved the solution in from it. Didn't even know about the cutoff on the way in.
Got it. Otherwise, you would have had a solution.
The one thing I've solved the amplitude.
Well, I am pretty sure I've simply solved the differential equation with that a.
Doing that compared to what you comparing that with what you started off doing corresponded to subtracting from logarithm c to version b.
That's possible. Yeah.
And if that affects the mode's way out.
I think
otherwise,
you may be saying right.
Okay.
All right. I mean, this is a good point, and I need to think about it. Let me mention one last thing, since time is nearly finished, which is to do with energy and momentum conservation, which Joe was asking about. So one attitude to this problem is these two brains collide, okay, and something happens here that we don't understand, which involves a regulator. But you might hope that whatever happens there, energy and momentum conservation will tell you about what comes out, will uniquely define the final state. Okay, in the sense that I've got a positive tension brain here, minus tension brain there. And then what comes out? Now, let's just take in as given that when these brains collide, they generate a certain amount of density on the brains. I'm just going to put that in as a parameter. Okay? This one is going to come out with a negative tension and some density. And let's assume that some calculation ignoring back reaction has fixed those two amounts. So we have a collision, we calculate these in the type of calculation Joe has done, which ignores back reaction, and then we go back to the original problem and say, no, but we've got to conserve energy and momentum, and that should fix the velocities of these outgoing brains. So does that make sense? Okay, so this one has a velocity v plus, that has a velocity v minus, this has a velocity v minus, v plus prime in the final state. So can energy and momentum conservation fix these two in terms of those two?
Well, how am I defining energy?
So energy is defined, so you do that as follows. Basically, you're thinking about this interaction as being something like a spring. These things come off, and it's an inelastic collision because the internal state's changed. And actually, when I first tried doing this, I got ridiculous answers. It's not so obvious you get a sensible answer in this calculation at all. But in fact, you do. And it's somewhat subtle why you do. But let's make another assumption, which is that in the initial state, you see, we've got a bulk space-time between these brains. Let's make the initial assumption that the bulk is static between the brains. Okay, so we have these two brains with a static bulk. Now, that means that in the initial conditions, you see, V plus and V minus are not independent. They are constrained. Basically, the Einstein equations constrain these two things together. I had that A naught prime squared equals A one prime squared. These are not independent. And the reason they're not independent is that they both have to sit in this bulk space-time. They have to be embedded in it. And what that equation looks like, so Israel, when these things come, the Israel matching condition looks like this, equals, if the warp factor is a squared of y, then it looks like a squared prime over a squared. So basically the kink, the slope of the warp factor tells you how fast you have to be going to match. Now when they get close, it's obvious that the slope is the same for the plus brain and the minus brain, as long as the warp factor is smooth. So in fact, this condition tells you that this has to be equal. That's the number T. So you see, the positive tension one has a kink in this direction, the negative has a kink in that direction. So the T is a positive number. Negative tension brain has tension minus T. So that's Israel. So it tells you the velocities have to be equal and opposite when they collide. They can only collide if they're empty. Can only collide at equal opposite momentum. Now, energy, total energy.
Wasn't that your constraint before?
Yes, it was. Essentially, it is. In the small velocity limit, it's the same. So again, the moduli space agrees with this. Okay, so what's the total energy? Well, it's T over root 1 minus V plus squared minus T over root 1 minus V minus squared. Just the gamma factor for the brain motion.
What does total energy mean in gravity? I mean, how do you relate this to the fact that total energy is zero in gravity? I mean, you're
what part is of the energy?
Well, it's zero.
There's no exchange between the brains.
It is zero. What?
It's always zero.
This is a constraint. Okay, so that's the constraint equation. That's the constraint equation. That's like total energy being zero. This is the energy as measured by... So you see, when they collide, the bulk warp factor is basically negligible, and you can think about it happening in a little region of Minkowski space, mm-hmm. where energy is perfectly normally defined. What do you mean by asymptotically?
Well, energy is only defined.
Yeah.
Local energy.
Locally.
Energy is not local energy.
What I'm saying is you can pretend this is in Minkowski space at short distances, and then the energy is. Then the obvious definition of the energy is the right one. So that's the energy,
and
but
this
you.
This is the energy of. You're saying this is like the.
You can do all this exactly in ADS, and it agrees absolutely with the naive form. Okay, so the total energy turns out to be zero because the velocities have to be equal and opposite. So even if they're moving, the total energy has to be zero. The negative tension brain has negative energy. But now you come and work out the total momentum, and that's not zero because... This is total momentum in the y direction. I agree that there is not... There is... The way I think about it is that there is a force between those two brains, okay? And the force, if the force is equal and opposite, it will conserve total momentum. You do not need to have translation invariance.
I mean, what is the momentum?
I think there actually is translation invariance when you think about it carefully. I mean, it's because it doesn't matter whether I picked coordinates here where this is y1 plus a constant, you know, sorry, y minus.
That's the problem.
You need a Killing vector to get the observed quantity, and you don't have anything like the Killing vector.
You do in the limit of small separation because the bulk warp factor is.
Rock Killing vector in that direction. There's no transfer.
Dy. Dy squared. The metric's
dy.
It's
a wall.
There is that way of thinking about it. There's another way of thinking about it, which is that.
Maybe we should.
Which is.
We actually.
Fine.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
We can argue about this afterwards.
Fine. Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.